Radio Exterior de España.
English Language Service. Hello and a warm welcome from Madrid. I'm Alison Hughes. Our studio manager tonight is Elena Sanz. First, the news headlines. Jobless claims in Spain rise in September. Italy's Prime Minister wins a confidence vote in Parliament. And Russia charges Greenpeace activists with piracy.
Noticias en Radio Exterior de España.
The summer season in Spain is over and 52,000 service sector jobs were eliminated in September. The number of registered jobless has risen by 0.5% or 25,572 people. The rise in unemployment last month was the first in 7 months. Prime Minister Rajoy nonetheless hailed the figures delivered by the Labour Ministry. It's the best jobless data for September in many years. It's not enough. We must create jobs and solidly. But the tendency is now changing, and this encourages us to continue working with determination and valor.
Pero ahora la tendencia está cambiando, y eso nos anima a seguir trabajando con ahínco, con determinación y con coraje.
The number of registered jobless in the country is 4.7 million. Spain has been in recession for most of the past 4 years, but the government has forecast that the economy will grow this year. In industry and construction, the jobless level continued to fall. The jobless rate in Spain stood at 26.3% in the second quarter, down from a record 27.2% in the first quarter. The figure was boosted by the start of the tourism season. Tourism accounts for about 10% of Spain's gross domestic product. For the first time in a decade, remittances sent back by Spaniards living abroad have surpassed those sent out of the country by immigrants living in Spain. According to the figures from the Bank of Spain, remittances received in the second quarter of this year totaled nearly 1.6 billion euros. That is 28 million euros more than what immigrants have sent out of Spain. Spain's rampant unemployment has caused an increasing number of Spanish workers to leave. Almost 60,000 emigrated last year, while 135,000 foreign workers residing in Spain left the country. However, the platform remesas.org, which specializes in remittances, notes that the Bank of Spain's figures do not provide a breakdown of the countries from which the remittances were sent, nor the profile of the Spaniards sending them. It suggests that most Spaniards who move abroad are young, qualified workers who do not earn enough money to send home, and that the bulk of the money was maybe being sent by naturalized Spaniards who have returned to their countries of origin and are sending money to relatives who remain in Spain. An explosion in Zaragoza's Basilica, El Pilar, resulted in the evacuation of the cathedral but caused no material or personal damage. The basilica was open to the public at the time of the explosion and Spanish police immediately cordoned the area. Police investigators suspect left-wing extremists may have been behind the blast, linking it to a homemade device placed in Madrid's Almudena Cathedral last February 7th. That device was deactivated and an anarchist group called Comando Mateo Morral claimed responsibility. The blast at the Zaragoza shrine is believed to have been caused by a gas camping stove. Witnesses awaiting the 2 p.m. Mass said that they heard a loud bang and saw smoke billowing from the central aisle leading to the altar. Spain's state prosecutor will be investigating the exhibition and market installed last Saturday at a public high school in a village in the province of Madrid, in which fascist symbols from the Franco and Nazi eras were displayed and sold. The state-funded high school in Kirjona hosted a market selling flags from the Franco and Nazi dictatorships, swastikas, SS insignia, and pictures of José Antonio Primo de Rivera, the founder of the Spanish Falangists. A banner ran above the stands with a fascist slogan, "Salute Franco, arriba España, long live Spain." Mercedes García, the popular party mayor of Kijorna, later apologized but says she will not step down despite calls for her resignation from the opposition socialist party in Madrid's regional government. The market was denounced by the village socialist councillor Azucena Consejo, who said the town hall has made a public space available where not only Franco-era symbols were for sale, but also Nazi insignia, which in Germany is illegal and constitutes a crime. Spain's state prosecutor Eduardo Torres Dulce told the press today,
El Ministerio Fiscal se va a mostrar
The Ministry of State Prosecution will be vigilant from every point of view, both for administrative infractions and for crimes, and no space for impunity will be given to any activity that not only breaks the law, but also the spirit of the Constitution, that is, the state of law and every Spaniard's right to peaceful cohabitation and democracy. Italian Prime Minister Enrico Letta has won a decisive victory in a confidence vote on his government in the Senate. Earlier, Silvio Berlusconi performed a complete U-turn, backing Letta in an emotional speech following days of political twists and turns. Over the weekend, Berlusconi seemed poised to topple the government as he withdrew his party ministers from Letta's coalition and called for fresh elections. Since then, however, a flood of Berlusconi allies defected, pledging to support the government, a fragile right-left coalition that has only been in place since April. Of the 307 senators called on to take part in the vote, 235 voted in favor of Enrico Letta's government and 70 against.
Senatori favorevoli 235, senatori contrari 70, senatori astenuti 0, il Senato approva.
The Hungarian government has passed a law to prohibit sleeping in the streets. Another law also prohibits searching for food in the garbage, which the parliament identifies as state property. The homeless and indigent now face prison sentences if they are found near national monuments and other tourist attractions. Budapest and other towns will now establish restricted areas that the most impoverished people will be prohibited from entering. The Prime Minister Viktor Orban, leader of the right-wing nationalist party Fidesz, tried to put the measure into law a year ago, but the Constitutional Court overruled him. Orban then changed the members of the court and succeeded in passing an identical law. The Hungarian parliament is dominated by the Fidesz party and its allies on the extreme right, Jobbik. The opposition has declared the law inhuman and the government propaganda to show economic success in the midst of rising public hardship. In Budapest alone, some 8 to 10,000 people are homeless and shelters have space for only 6,000. The law is due to come into force next week. Meanwhile, Hungary's deputy prime minister has said the state is determined to crack down on hate crimes and stamp out resurgent anti-Semitism in the country. The Jobbik party has attacked Jews and Israel in speeches in parliament where they hold 43 of the 386 seats. Hungary still has one of the largest and oldest Jewish communities in Europe, despite the fact that more than 500,000 were killed in the Holocaust during the Second World War. French President François Hollande has told two of his top ministers that they should end a public row over France's policy towards its Roma population if they want to stay in his government. Last week, Interior Minister Manuel Valls said most of some 20,000 Roma or gypsies housed in makeshift camps around French cities could never be integrated into French society and so should be taken back to the border and returned to Romania and Bulgaria. Housing Minister Cécile Duflot, a leader of the Green Coalition partners to the ruling socialists, denounced Mr. Valls for betraying the core human rights values that France prided itself on. The extreme right National Front says it plans to make the Roma issue a central campaign theme for next March's municipal elections. Since the beginning of the year, some 13,000 Roma have been evicted from their camps in France. Welfare groups say the failure of plans to rehouse them leaves them on the streets or to set up new camps elsewhere. In the United States, in view of the government shutdown and congressional impasse, President Barack Obama has canceled stops in Malaysia and the Philippines as part of his upcoming trip to Asia. He has postponed his trip until Saturday. The partial shutdown of the U.S. federal government is in its second day with no signs of progress in the standoff between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans brought about the shutdown after tying government funding to a delay on the health insurance plan known as Obamacare. The shutdown means furloughs for more than 800,000 government employees and forces millions more to work without pay. The health care bill, which was passed a few years ago, aims to provide medical coverage to some 48 million Americans. Washington has expelled Venezuela's highest-ranking diplomat in the United States and two others from its embassy in retaliation for Venezuela's expulsion of three American diplomats. Yesterday, President Nicolás Maduro accused the American officials of fomenting sabotage in his country. The Venezuelan government has said the U.S. decision cannot be considered reciprocal because the Venezuelan diplomats did not meet with opponents to the U.S. government or people interested in acting against it. Despite their frayed political relations, the United States remains Venezuela's main oil export market, behind only Canada, Saudi Arabia, and Mexico as the U.S.'s most important oil suppliers. Police in Brazil used stun guns and tear gas to disperse crowds during a protest in Rio de Janeiro. Teachers were holding a rally to demand better working conditions. They claim Brazil has a shortage of at least 300,000 primary school teachers, which is leading to overcrowded classes and a weak learning environment. Brazil has seen numerous anti-government rallies since June, with protesters demanding more public spending on schools, public health, and transport. Meanwhile, work on a Brazilian soccer stadium, which is being refurbished for the 2014 World Cup, has been suspended after a judge ruled there were safety concerns. The stadium in Curitiba is due to stage four matches during the World Cup. Work on the stadium is already behind schedule. And 14 Greenpeace activists held in Russia have been charged with piracy over a recent protest against the country's first offshore oil rig in the Arctic. The charges are punishable by up to 15 years in prison. On September 18th, Russian authorities detained about 30 activists after several of them tried to scale the Gazprom platform, protesting that its exploratory drilling is an ecological danger. Environmentalists warn that drilling in the Arctic puts the fragile ecosystem there at risk and could lead to a full-scale oil disaster. Russia's first offshore oil rig in the Arctic is expected to start operating by the end of the year. Other oil companies, including ExxonMobil, Eni, and Statoil, have already agreed deals to enter Russia's Arctic offshore waters.
Radio Exterior de España. The news.
Back in Spain, a gas storage plant in construction off of Spain's Mediterranean coast may be the cause of a sudden spate of earthquakes in an area not known for seismic activity. Technicians from Spain's Industry and Energy Ministry have visited the Castor gas storage plant in Castellón to determine whether a recent series of earthquakes in the area was provoked by the plant's gas extraction process. Activity at the offshore subterranean gas storage plant was halted after 200 minor earthquakes were detected last week around the area of Vinaros on the Ebro Delta. Yesterday, a small earthquake, but the strongest yet, struck shortly after the government halted work on the huge plant. Spain's National Geographic Institute said the earthquake measured 4.2 magnitude, the strongest ever in an area not known for seismic activity. No buildings in the area were damaged. Scientists are now studying whether the injections of gas into the gas storage plant triggered the quakes. The EU-backed facility, developed by Spain's ACS and Dundee Energy of Canada, began injecting the so-called cushion gas needed to provide pressure to extract the remaining gas from storage in July. The tremors started at the same time as the gas injections. Industry Minister José Manuel Soria told reporters. They're studying whether there's any cause and effect between the injection of this cushion of gas and the microquakes. We don't have scientific proof for it, but they say it's a possibility. The project involves storing 1.3 billion cubic meters of gas in a depleted oil reservoir under the Mediterranean Sea and sending it via pipeline to Spain's national grid when needed. Environmental groups have fought the plant since its conception in 2007. Mayors in the region have requested an urgent meeting with the Spanish government. The earthquakes have been low intensity but affected around 75,000 people living along the coastline. The area's fishing community has also accused the plant's contractors of threatening their livelihoods. The Castor offshore underwater gas storage facility aims to begin operating next year and is meant to store 30% of Spain's daily natural gas needs. Spain imports almost all of its gas and oil. The plant is designed to help guarantee supplies and keep prices stable. The question is, at what cost to the environment? And that's the news.
Radio Exterior de España.
Una Madrid.
Ida tu España al
Jarijia. Why don't you tune in to Madrid Diary on Radio Exterior de España?
Vous écoutez notre émission en français sur Radio Exterior de España.
Международная служба испанского национального радио.
Radio Exterior de España. Emisión en portugués para
Brasil. Emisión sefarad. Tu programa en lengua sefardí.
Radio Exterior de España.
Some people have all the luck. I was green with envy when I heard that one of our colleagues from the Spanish service of Radio Exterior had been to interview the actress who has just been voted the sexiest woman in the world for the second year in succession by the readers of the international edition of Glam Mag magazine. I've never heard of Glam Mag before, but I have to confess that I agree with their reader's choice. For the lady in question is none other than Kim Cattrall, who played Samantha Jones, that deliciously frank, man-eating sex bomb in the television series Sex and the City. Ms. Cattrall, who's 57, describes herself as a Liverpool-born, Canadian-raised New Yorker, and she's in Madrid taking part in an event organised by the New York Times called Time Talks. A couple of nights ago, she got up on stage at the Teatro Español in the capital to answer the public's questions about herself. The lucky man who got to see her and talk to her after her performance is Salvador Jiménez, and this is his interview.
Kim Cattrall, welcome to Spain.
Thank you very much.
Have you already felt the love of Spanish people in these Time Talks?
Oh, yes, it's been a wonderful evening. I mean, to go out on the stage and for everyone to be so excited and happy to see me, it was a wonderful welcome.
In the Time Talks, people were very participative. So did you feel comfortable with the question of the audience?
Yes, I mean, it's awkward not speaking Spanish, and I wish I did speak Spanish because, you know, when you get a question in Spanish, you're waiting for the translation. And then when the audience reacts after hearing the question in Spanish, and there's a ooh, you think, what can that question be? It's a little scary. But the questions were really, really impressive.
Now Kim Cattrall is going to be on TV very soon with Sensitive Skin. How sensitive is Kim Cattrall?
Well, my skin is very sensitive. I think I am sensitive. I think that if I wasn't, I don't think I would be an actor because my feelings they're very close to my skin. I pride myself in trying to listen to people and to be open to people. And when someone is rude or impatient, I can fight back, but it can also, you know.
And what type of woman we are going to see in this new series?
Sensitive Skin is a half-hour comedy, and I play a woman called Davina Jackson, and she's been married for 30 years with her husband, Al, and they have a son, Orlando. Mm-hmm. And suddenly she starts to have feelings that she has led a life that she's not satisfied with, but she doesn't know why, and it creeps up on her by these visitations of different people in her life, either imaginary or real, who start to say to her, you have to look at what's going on in your life. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be, you're in your 50s now. It's more than half over, baby. What have you done with your life? Mm-hmm. Which I think is one of the fascinating and scary things about a midlife crisis, is that you're not even aware totally of what's happening to you, but something's different. Women change their hair, they change their car, they change their home, their location. They're trying to find outward answers to something that maybe is not realized within themselves. But this is a really fresh material because no one has ever taken this and really opened it up and taken a look at it and also used humor to do so. So I'm very excited about it. It's very new.
Last month you finished Sweet Bird of Youth in the Old Vic in London. You were Alexandra del Lago. Do you feel more comfortable in the theater? It doesn't matter if you are in the cinema, if you are in the TV.
The thing that I love most about theater is the rehearsal process. There usually isn't time for that when you're doing television or film, or very little of it. And it's usually just before you're about to do the scene. You work alone, and then you come and hope that the other actors have the same understanding that you have, and sometimes that's not the case. But in a rehearsal situation, the director is leading you to a unified vision of what the playwright intended and who the character is, mm-hmm. and how we're going to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And I love that camaraderie. I love that feeling of collaboration with the actors and the director and the costumer and the and even the crew. It feels to me a very organic experience that I enjoy, instead of very much a technical experience, which television and film can be.
Well, some colleagues of you, for example, Ewan McGregor, you work with him, Naomi Watts, they work, for example, they made Spanish cinema. Would you like to do Spanish cinema one day?
Oh my God, yes, I do. I love the Spanish actors, and I went to the theater here. I don't remember what I saw in the 80s, but it was just so beautifully realized and done with humor and panache. And I love the, you know, I think about Spain and those Hemingway novels that I read when I was very young, of blood and sand, and it has a real romance for me.
Do you love Almodóvar?
Oh, my God, yes, I do. I just think he's a genius. There was talk of him possibly directing a Sex in the City episode, and we were so excited, but unfortunately it never happened.
Well, there are many roles, Alexandra del Lago, Cleopatra, Monica Bellur, Amélie, and one of them is really special for Spanish people and for all your fans is Samantha Jones. All fans, when we announced the interview, told me, Salvador, you have to ask if it's possible one day in the future that she come back with this role.
Oh, that's such a great question, and I take it as such a wonderful compliment. But I don't know if it will happen. I feel that it was a very special time and place, mm-hmm. and the world has changed. We've moved on. So I think the only reason to go back is to tell a story that is relevant. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that story exists. That would be in the writer's hand.
Mm-hmm. And what is the secret? Because the first season was in 1998. And now, for example, as Spanish people, we can continue watching the show and we enjoy it. What is the secret?
I think that it's the friendship. Mm-hmm. And I think that what the show did in a really beautiful way was it represented those four friends as family. Mm-hmm. Outside of your mother and the family that you don't choose, you choose a family of women who are for each other. And I think that that's what people love about it, is that no matter what, these four women will stick together. And they, as I said in the talk today for New York Times talk, it really is one woman realized through four characters. Mm-hmm. So I think everyone can relate, not just to one character, but parts of all of them. And I just think it's fun. The fashion's fun. The time was fun. It has nostalgia and stardust attached to it because those were good days, good times.
Mm-hmm. We are going to finish. What are you going to do this weekend in Madrid?
Cuisine and culture. That's it. Yeah, sadly, I have to go back on Sunday. But I'm really looking forward tomorrow to go through the Prado and explore the great treasures and the great history of Spain.
Have you eaten tapas? Because I read on your Twitter you went to eat tapas and go to the Prado Museum.
Yes. I'm here in Madrid for culture and cuisine. It's just rampant here. I love Spanish food. Even in London, one of my favorite restaurants is a tapas.
Really?
Yes, I love it so much.
Kim Cattrall, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome to Face to Face, the space where we devote time to analysis and discussion of the major issues of the day, both here in Spain and on the international stage. In our programme today, we're going to talk about Brazil. Not the Brazil of next year's World Cup, or of the Olympic Games in 2016, not the Brazil of an emerging economy that one day might take off to become one of the strongest in the world. It'll take time, but it will eventually get there. But of the Brazil that is still desperately poor, and whose invisible citizens, those who live in the favelas or shantytowns of the big cities, desperately need help to make it, not to the end of the month, but to the end of each day. With Alison and myself in the studio is Leonardo Martins Dias, Leo, a Brazilian who's a strategic advisor in sustainability. He's in Spain at the moment to promote some of the projects he's involved with in his native country. Leo, welcome to Face to Face.
Thank you very much, Frank, Alison, Elena. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. I said you are a strategic advisor in sustainability. What does it mean?
I work for Poverty Alleviation and International Cooperation for Development. This means that the main objective is to increase life conditions in the private areas, really to put people first. The way we do that is through inclusive business models, empowering grassroots leaders to enhance communities' autonomy. Locals have to be the protagonist of their change. We need to bring visibility to people who have great ideas and great initiatives to enhance life's condition locally. In the same way, for the companies, we positionate private companies' brands. There's an inclusive business model that we develop. We develop new products and services oriented to this new market, that is this people who is having a bigger consumption power now. But this consumption power must be turned in engagement power with the society, companies, government, NGOs, universities. I mean, people who can consume, these people can also engage all these stakeholders to develop new business models so that they can enhance communities' autonomy and life's conditions. I do that bridging to facilitate agreements among different stakeholders, private companies, governments, academias, NGOs, communities, media. And we also build an innovative social responsibility trajectory, a history, a track, a path to these stakeholders that contribute in this process.
Well, now you had, in an interview you did in El País a year ago, you mentioned the example of a telecommunications company in Brazil that went into the favela. Oi, I think it's called.
Oi, yes.
Could you tell us about that? Because they actually went in to one of the favelas and set up shop. Is that right?
No, they set up the place where the customers call when you have a doubt or something like that. Mm-hmm. It calls
customer service?
The customer service. They implement the customer service inside the community. We identified that it's not difficult to prepare people to be attendants to customers. So this way we give jobs. It's very important to create jobs and generate incomes. So this is a way of position this brand and to leave a concrete legacy to people who live in the favela.
But am I correct in understanding then they put the customer service center in the favela, hired from that community?
Yes.
And so also, I guess, changing a submerged economy into an incorporated. Is that right? Also, they now have social security and health benefits. And
this call center that they created inside the favela, we have also a place where we do a training programs to enhance their skills. We also facilitate some activities that they want, like they love games, you know, the games with computers. And so in their free time, they can stay there and they can play. They can play music. So it's a way also to deliver options to these people, no? Because if not, they are in the streets. And in the favelas, it's very difficult to find an area or a park where you can be with people, get in touch, exchange ideas. So we try to facilitate this kind of
Talking about games, I said at the beginning we weren't going to be talking about the Olympic Games, but I can't help it because one of your programs that you're involved in is called War and Peace in the Olympic shantytown. Can you tell us something more about that?
That was very interesting. It was a documentary we did last November. We recorded in Brazilian favelas. We were there with Televisión Española, with Alicia Gomez and Susana Pons. And I articulated part of the interviews. I also gave a short interview. And my objective was to bring visibility to these leaders through this documentary so that the world can see, can understand, can know what kind of initiatives they are developing to enhance life conditions so that they can fundraise, they can get in touch with organizations that could afford funds for their projects.
But when people go to the Rio Olympics in 2016, yes, will they see favelas close to where the Olympic Stadium and the Olympic Village is going to be?
In my opinion, sure.
So it'll be visible?
Yes, I think it will be visible. Yes.
The Brazilian government won't do anything to clean it up and kind of hide it behind something.
We're talking about in Rio 1.2 million people and more than 1,000 favelas. Officially, there are 762, but it's more than 1,000. So I think if they can do that, I will be very impressed. I don't think so. No. I don't think it will be
so
possible.
People will be aware of the poverty.
Yes, yeah. Yes. People are aware of the poverty. Mm. Situation is becoming better. Good things are happening. But the problem is very big. It's very, for 100 years, society, private companies, government really didn't care too much to the favelas growing and to the poverty. So now we need lots of time, lots of energy, and to work together in order to solve the situation.
So that means that for you and people like you, actually having the World Cup and the Olympics within 2 years in Brazil has actually been good because it sort of promotes your objective as well.
Yes, it's good because I believe that who need to be promoted is the people who are working inside, the people who live in the community, the people who really knows this reality. I had lots of experience in the favela since I was a children because my mother was a volunteer working in social projects in favelas. But also lots of money, lots of investment is going to Brazil. A few part of this investment is going to social projects, but yes, we are having more facilities to develop some projects. We have this kind of activity, this kind of documentaries, this interest in the media. So, yeah, somehow it's good. But I think that we could do more. A lot of money is going to Brazil, and I think that we could spend more money in social issues, like the riots now. I think that all the society is asking for that.
Well, that's right. In fact, the Olympics and the World Cup Games were the backdrop, in part, for those massive demonstrations that were prompted by such things as a hike in the price of public transportation, something that basic. And I think there were also, the other issue was medical expense. So this massive demonstration came out, and one of the things they said was, there's corruption here. We don't want this money. What's all this money going for infrastructure? That makes organizations like your own that much more important, no? It puts more pressure on you to really reach people.
Yes. The transportation fare, I think it's kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's a shame. Situation in Brazil, our system, not also in Brazil, in all the world, is a shame what we are doing.
What do you mean? It's too expensive? Or what? Transportation system?
I mean, part of the small part of the world living with so very money. Good conditions, and most of people in very bad conditions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think that the 20 centimes are, this is peanuts. That's not the point. What really people ask, in my opinion, is true democracy, the end of corruption, public bodies with efficiency, efficient public bodies. I think that this violence, I don't agree with violence. It's like a cancer that kills the body that gives it life. But Brazilian society speak the language of violence, and the riots reflect that. Mm. In the riots, you could see all kind of people asking many things, including the violence. But I think that what makes people to be in this emotional situation is that we have enough money to have a much better society. But the money don't get to the education that's important, is a very important route for social development, to the health system. Transportation is awful. It's not the money, but the conditions. It's very difficult to move in Brazilian cities. I was now in a project that I have with Fundação Mafre in Amazonas, in Manaus, and I tried to go to the project by bus, and it's crazy. You have to wait for a long time, and when the bus arrives, people have to fight to get inside the bus, and in your trip, you will be stolen for sure. Even people robbed, even people who live there. So kind of situation that I cannot understand. It's a question of priorities, because Brazil has a lot of money. It's the sixth biggest economy now, front of UK, you know, they say.
There's an awful lot of coffee in Brazil, they say. You said Brazilians are speaking the language of violence, but Brazilians also speak many other languages, the language of music, the language of samba, the language, I suppose, of rap, hip-hop. Part of your program, part of your ideology, I might call it, isn't an ideology, but you know what I mean, part of your philosophy, is to use those different languages of the people to get to them and to, in some sense, teach them what they can do, what's available, and to contact with the rest of society. Explain how do you use music to improve the situation of ordinary people?
I mean, when I said that Brazil speak the language of violence, is that because when you are there, you see that people, young people prepare to fight many times. Lots of people don't do that, but you see that it's common. You breathe violence in the streets much more than you breathe it in Europe, in Madrid, for example. What I developed is a social technology. I call a social technology. The first step is to ensure security so that we can work inside the communities. We also work inside communities without the pacification, with less security. But one of the important parts is to use local language, rap, hip-hop, theater, sports. That's a tool to engage young people, to engage people to participate in the project. It's not that easy. Like, people many times think that you will do a project and everybody will say, oh, great, let's learn Portuguese or maths or English. No, it's very, very difficult for the young guys who are in the street to concentrate, you know, to go many times to have the means so that people can get to the place. So music is a very good tool to engage, you know. So we begin with the music, and then to continue the music, we began with some Portuguese class, then maps, and then we include support, the assessment to university, support the employment. I mean, how to get a job, how to do an interview, how to do a CV, what kind of jobs companies are needing. Before everything, we understand what kind of jobs the company is needing, as we do, for example, in Manaus, in Amazonas. This project is with Fundação Mafre. And then, for example, in Amazonas, we create an employment agency. It's physically inside the community, and it's a place where people can go and have information, choose some training program. That's the social technology, you know. That's another. There are other points in this.
So music and other languages are just the hook to get the people in.
That's it.
And to interest them.
It's a hook.
Well, you know, I don't know if this is true of the favela, but I imagine it is. In the equivalent of favelas in American cities, many of the young people who grow up in these neighborhoods never actually leave and are very afraid of the city that surrounds them or the city that's near them. So I'm just wondering, and going back to how much of a presence do you find that you're able to create within the community also? Because I think in order for someone to get out of the community and go, it's a very big step. Is that true in Brazil?
Yes.
I mean, it's a tremendous challenge to leave your slum.
In Santa Marta, for example, it's a favela in Rio. There were 780 stairs to get to the favela. And some people, they were 30 years without go to the cities. Few people, for mm-hmm. sure. Old mm-hmm. people, people who work with drug dealing, with narcotraffic. But yes, in Salvador de Bahia, for example, where I have a project with Fundación Mafre, I was talking with people last time I go there, now in July, and they were telling me that they don't know really the city. They just go to the city to work. They mm-hmm. all their lives is inside the favelas.
And is drug consumption a big problem within the favelas, apart from the mafia, the drugs lords and dealers? Mm-hmm. Is there a problem of consumption?
Yes, we have a big problem with crack. Mm-hmm. It's a very dangerous drug. It's I don't know exactly how to explain, but it's the rest of the cocaine.
Yeah.
It's very addictive.
No, they used to refer to it as the marketing genius for evil, in that it sells very cheap. It's very addictive, and it produces tremendously erratic, often violent behavior. It's a terrible addiction.
On the other hand, there are some favelas where the drug dealers are not selling this drug, and they are stopping to sell this because they are having lots of problems inside the community, because people really, when you see people who are drug dealers with crack, they are in very bad situation. They are in very bad... as if they were not in their bodies, you know, they don't know what they are doing. So they began to create some problems inside the community, and the drug dealers don't want that. Uh-huh. Some place they forbidden.
They ban it.
Yes, some place, not all. Mm-hmm.
That leads me to another question. When you go in, who are the centers of power in the favela? And if they are the drug lords, does that mean that you have to go to talk to them and appeal to them in order to set something up?
Yes, sometimes I have to do that, but I also go with people who live in the community, in the favela. I don't get inside the favela by myself. And okay.
Yeah.
No, it's not like that. But yes, you have to agree that you do a social project. Like Vigário Geral, for example, we record some... a part of this documentary in Vigário Geral, and before going with Televisão Espanhola there, we had to make an agreement with them that we would go, we would not record in some place, and they let us go there.
They more or less gave you a passport.
Yes, they gave us a passport. In some kinds, we have some kinds like Complexo do Alemão, where the one of the more powerful drug dealers asked us to take care of his son, so that his son worked with us in social projects, because he didn't want his son to have the same life that he is having.
So you find actually that the many of these drug lords want the presence of social change in their community, or not?
Sometimes. It's not a rule. Not so, sometimes yes, sometimes not. What happened with the pacification process in Rio, the police peacekeeping unit, is that when they put the drug dealers out, you have a leadership empty place.
Yeah,
I don't know
vacuum,
exactly how to say.
Vacuum of power.
Vacuum of power.
And this is the place that we are trying to fill with local leaders committed with the social development. Mm-hmm.
Now, you've mentioned Fundación Mafre three times.
Yes.
Mafre is a Spanish insurance company.
Yes.
And it has a foundation for social work.
Yes.
That brings me to, what are you doing now here in Spain? Are you looking for supporters of your projects, people who will back you, people who will give you money? Or are you looking for investors, perhaps?
Well, many things. From one side, looking for investors. I came to Spain because I was working for Telefonica in a Brazilian branch. They made me a proposition to work in the headquarters. I specialize in sustainability and CSR, in corporate social responsibility. And
but you no longer work for Telefonica.
No. Now I work for my own business.
And for your own mental health.
Yeah, free man.
I said that.
Yeah, we said.
And these companies who I realized when I came to work with Telefonica that Spain is a gate to America Latina for European organizations. So the IBEX 35, the Spanish companies that invest in Brazil and America Latina, they realize also that they have to contribute with social development in order to develop new markets, to develop relations with organizations, government. So they are investing in social projects, but many times they don't know exactly how to do it. And what I do is the planning on how to do it, that fitting in your business strategy, in your business plan of your company, maximizing results, creating new products and service, doing your branding. But the main point is to leave a real, concrete, and measurable legacy to the people who live in the communities. Mafre is very, very committed with that.
Mention one specific project that you're working on now.
With Mafre, you mean?
Or with anybody. Your latest, your best project at the moment, the one that interests you most.
Well, the project, I have a project that I'm very interested in, and now is a project we will do, everything is confirmed, we will do in November. We will do a training program. I develop a strategy for Lead International to do a training program inside the favela.
Well, just before you, Lead International, that's based in London. Just what is Lead International? Because our listeners might not know.
Okay. Lead International is an organization. It was created, an NGO created in ECO 92 in Rio de Janeiro by Rockefeller Foundation.
Yeah, an NGO created by a Rockefeller Foundation.
Yes. It's a consultative organization to the UN, to United Nations, and our main goal is to train new leaders for sustainability.
Fine.
To train a new generation of leaders to achieve sustainability.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted so that our listeners knew what we were talking about when we talk about Lead International. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you were talking about this project, the one that interests you, that starts in November.
Okay, yes. So we are going with a group of lead members who will become fellows. It's a training program. They are studying, they are doing a training program about leadership for sustainability. And I develop in this social technology a project to work inside the communities. Now, I believe that we need to empower the people who live in the community. We have to work with them. We have to co-create the projects. I don't believe in the solution that someone from outside the community get inside and have, look, I have the solution for your life. It doesn't work like that. So we will co-create a project that will be implemented then. Leaders who work inside the communities, the grassroots leaders, we will learn how to structure, how to communicate a project and to work with big organizations that with what maybe they don't speak the same language. They will see that it's possible. They will see that they can teach because they will learn and teach. So we create a real network. Mm-hmm. We develop knowledge and skills through experience. We will create the project together. We will structure this project together, and then we will implement this project together. So government bodies will, I'm articulating this to government bodies to participate, the police, companies, so that we can work with all these stakeholders and create this network.
Mm-hmm. And based and very based with the entire commitment and incorporation of the community itself.
Yes.
That's the heart, and
yes.
it just comes out.
But
from
what
there.
Would the end product of one of these programs be? You train people, you teach them how to be leaders, you give them the wherewithal to work within their own communities. What would you hope that they would set up or do at the end? Give me an example of somebody who maybe has already done it.
Many, yes, there are many examples. The main difficulty many times is how to structure a project. They have lots of good ideas. They know their needs, and they have very creative ideas.
For instance,
part of this technology to work with the music to engage people or to develop projects in which we put together police and ex-drug dealers to develop, to do shot movies so that one understands the history of the other and they realize that they are not so different as many times they could imagine before. Mm-hmm. In the end of this project, Lead International team learned how to work with the community. Grassroots leaders from the community learn how to structure a project, how to communicate and negotiate this project with founders, financial, with the companies, the organizations which give the financial resource. This project that we do together, in the end, they present this project to companies that I am articulating to be there. One of these companies usually finance this project. So they implement the project, they have a salary to do that, and generate an increase of life conditions with this project. This project can be like the call center, or can be an educational project, or can be a social incubator. We have in Olympic Games framework, developed a plan to the prefecture of Rio and the government. And it's based on the social entrepreneurs incubator so that they can develop their projects. So I really believe in this multiplication that happens inside the community after this training program from the from Lead International, Lead Canada in this case. Lead Canada will be participating inside a community.
What would you say your obstacles? Now, you've told us about wonderful things. What are some of the obstacles, and not necessarily within the favela, that Lead or that you and your projects have had to overcome? Where has there been most resistance in your work?
Well, you have to communicate and engage a very different kind of stakeholders. You are speaking this at the same time with NGOs, companies, governments, universities, media, community. So the word green for the NGO is one thing, for the private company is another thing, for the government is so that's a difficulty, but it's going very well. I think that's a point of attention. I have always to be very, very attentive to this fact.
No.
Leonardo, we could talk about this until the 2016 Olympics were over, but thank you very much for coming to join us. And as Alison said before, best of luck with all the projects.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation, for the interest in the work we are developing. I have more information, detailed information on my webpage.
What's the webpage? Give us the address.
It's leonardomartinsdias.com. Yeah. 3w.leonardomartinsdias.com.
I'll say that in an English accent.
Thank you.
www.leonardo, just like the painter, Martins, like St. Martin's Lane, Dias.com.
Thank you very much. That's it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça, ela menina que vem e que passa, num doce balanço caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado do sol de Ipanema, o seu balançado é mais que um poema, é a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Ah, por que estou tão sozinho? Ah, por que tudo é tão triste? Ah, beleza que existe. Ah, beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah. When she walks, She's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently that when she passes, each one she passes goes ah. Oh, but he watched her so sadly.
Radio Exterior de España.
Our email address is english@rtve.es and our snail mail address is Radio Exterior de España, P.O. Box 156-202, Madrid, 28080, Spain.
Radio Exterior de España.
English Language Service. Hola Madrid. Al kismo el árabe y shani la ruska.
Emisión francesa.
Estamos presentes en todo el mundo para estar contigo.
Música, esporte, actualidad.
Para llevarte la actualidad, la lengua, la cultura española a donde te encuentres.
Noticias es Radio Exterior de España.
Radio Exterior de España en el mundo y todo el mundo en Radio Exterior de España.